Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Karl Popper came to the LSE from his temporary refuge in New Zealand in 1946, and he stayed here until his retirement in 1969. In that time, he built up a thriving and famous department at the school, and through his numerous books and articles, established his own reputation as one of the most provocative and creative philosophers of the age. Popper's writings spanned practically the entire range of traditional philosophical thought, contributing as they do to the interpretation of ancient Greek philosophy, as well as to modern political philosophy, philosophy of science in all its aspects, and some of the deepest metaphysical issues. As a philosopher, he is like many of the famous philosophers of the past, like Kant, Hume, Leibniz, and Russell, whose central ideas and approaches seem to have application to most of the great issues of philosophy. Popper died last year at the grand age of 92, and one of a number of projects to honour his memory and perpetuate his philosophical ideals was the setting up at the LSE of the Sir Karl Popper Memorial Fund with the support of generous benefactors. The aim of the fund is to provide financial assistance to students in the form of scholarships and to hold an annual Popper lecture. And I'm pleased to say that through the fund, we have been able this year to award 4 Popper scholarships to graduate students, so enabling them to continue their studies in philosophy. This brings me to the business of this evening, the Sir Karl Popper Memorial Lecture. We are most fortunate in having Professor Patrick Suppes to deliver this, the first memorial lecture. Professor Suppes is one of the most distinguished and productive philosophers working today. He has spent almost all of his academic career at Stanford University, where he was professor, not only in the Department of Philosophy, but also in the Statistics Department. And over the same period, he held the position of Director of Stanford University's Institute for Mathematical Studies in the Social Sciences. Professor Suppes's publications comprise above 300 articles and books. Like Popper, his intellectual range is remarkable. One unifying aspect of his work is the precision, both logical and mathematical, that he brings to philosophical questions. Professor Suppes has contributed importantly to measurement theory, decision theory, the theory of games, and inductive reasoning. He is the author of a luminously clear and widely used textbook in logic. He has also written extensively on computer-assisted learning techniques, an expertise that also formed the basis for a prosperous business enterprise. And his ideas have prospered in another sense, in that they have been taken up by philosophers worldwide and spawned their own multinational industry of publications. For example, he more or less created the flourishing modern field of probabilistic causation, and his original writings in linear learning theory and on the semantic view of theories have proved equally fertile. More recently, Professor Suppes has focused on elucidating the ideas of determinism and freedom, and it is on the latter, a subject that was always very close to Popper's heart, that he will speak to us this evening. So it gives me great pleasure now to invite Professor Suppes to give the first Popper Memorial Lecture, which has the title, The Nature of Freedom. Professor Suppes.
Thanks very much, Peter, for the very generous introduction. And before I begin, I just want to relate one or two anecdotes about Karl Popper. I first met him almost 40 years ago when he came to Stanford to spend a year at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. And it's that time that I got acquainted with him. But I remember best a seminar on probabilistic causality I gave here at the London School of Economics at his invitation in the late 60s. Imre Lakatos was also there. And I can summarize that seminar in a way that many of you will understand. I was very lucky to get in a couple of words. We had a great time. I'm not too bashful myself. Now, to skip over the years, when Karl Popper was 89, I guess in 91, he visited Stanford and gave a talk at the invitation of the Department of Philosophy, and it was my pleasure to introduce him. And before introducing him, we chatted and had seen each other several times, and he said, "Now, I've recently had a series of minor strokes, and my health is not too good, so I think I should give this lecture sitting down, and it shouldn't last more than 35 or 40 minutes." Now, those of you who know Carl can imagine what happened. 5 minutes into the lecture, he was out of his chair, pacing up and down the stage. And after about an hour and 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I went up and gently said, "Well, Carl, maybe it's time to have some questions." And he kept up in that vigorous way really a surprising degree. I mean, it was one of the most vigorous performances of a philosopher of any age that I had seen. So it's a great pleasure and an honor to me to give this Karl Popper memorial lecture. And I do think the topic I want to talk about is one that was very congenial, and he's very explicit about that in various places. Very congenial to his philosophy. So I want to read occasional passages, but it's not my practice to read lectures. There are a few introductory and closing words summarizing some of the things. So let me begin by some general remarks. Much traditional and modern moral philosophy does not give a central place to the concept of freedom. But this is not true of perhaps the currently most influential moral philosopher, Immanuel Kant. The concept of freedom occupies a central place in Kant's critical philosophy. Those who have read his moral philosophy will think immediately of his concept of practical freedom. Those who have also studied the Critique of Pure Reason will think of transcendental freedom. Freedom in this sense is the power of beginning an act spontaneously. It cannot be determined by another cause preceding it in time, according to the laws of nature. In the analysis in the third antinomy, formulated rather late in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant also examines the idea of theoretical freedom, that is, the spontaneous power of beginning a process without causal predecessors in nature. But he settles for the complete determinism of the laws of nature, a matter on which I shall remark later. In the Critique of Judgment, Kant develops, in the second part, a biological teleology whose concepts are justifiably used in the study of nature when the available resources of mechanical explanation are limited. That is, more explicitly, our powers of giving such explanations are limited. For Kant, such a teleology is scientifically useful for explaining natural products. But even more central is that it provides the link between our actions in the world of experience and the moral law that is the formal condition for employing our freedom. I could develop these Kantian themes further here, but I sketch them to show that the underlying conception of the nature of freedom defended here is not derived from the utilitarian principles so commonly used by economists in their analysis of preference or choice. There are three fundamental concepts that are combined here by me in this lecture to describe the nature of freedom and the approach developed. These three concepts are individual autonomy, uncertainty or unpredictability, and the diversity of choice. I am under no illusion that these concepts, or the way I use them, will be adequate to account for all aspects of our intuitive ideas about freedom. I do think they provide a methodology for quantitatively analyzing some of the features of freedom most discussed in economics and political science, namely the freedom of markets and elections. The central concept is the Kantian one of individual autonomy, that is, of each rational being always thought of as an end in itself. Personal actions, fully controlled by another or by institutions, are not free actions. Intuitively, then, an election or market where there is no choice of candidates or products is not free. I propose as the other two concepts, uncertainty and diversity, with, as I shall develop below, entropy as a standard measure of uncertainty. The close connection between freedom and uncertainty is, in fact, the main focus of this lecture. So the one thing that I want to have you go away with after you've heard many different remarks by me here is the one aspect that I think has been most neglected in the history of philosophy in the analysis of the concept of freedom is the central place of the concept of uncertainty in our characterization of freedom. So freedom and uncertainty go hand in hand. That's the message that I want to deliver. Now let me give some examples. And I think it'll be easier to follow. Let's take a look at, by the way, I like to claim, even more than Karl Popper, I'm a genuinely empirical philosopher, and I'll give you various data here. American elections are, of course, a great topic of interest for someone like me as American and interested in freedom. I have in the paper actually some data from some British elections, for example, or parliamentary votes, but let me just concentrate on a few simple American cases. Of all the presidential elections in the United States, it's rather amusing that according to the characterization I want to give, and I'll be more formal in a minute, the election in 1796, one of the earliest elections, was the freest in the sense of the entropy of the election is 2.73. Here's the list of candidates and the Electoral College votes. In 1796, the popular vote is not recorded. Another famous election that had a great deal of freedom in the sense that I'm characterizing was the electoral vote in 1824, which had an entropy of 1.88. And those of you know who some fragments of American history, this election is famous for it's the only one that was thrown into the House of Representatives to decide because no candidate got a majority. In modern times, the election that was least evidence of freedom at work was the 1964 election in which Lyndon Johnson overwhelmed Barry Goldwater. And the entropy of that election is less than one, 0.98. It comes from the fact that in the popular vote, the percentage that Johnson had was very, very large compared to the popular vote for Goldwater, and the other candidates were negligible. So the way that I want to
Measure is just a standard measure of entropy of a set of alternatives where we have some notion of probability or proportion. Oh, yeah, remind me, Nancy, if I get it down in the way. So P sub I is the proportional vote, for example, for Johnson in that election. The log is to the base 2, and the entropy is just minus the sum of P sub I log P sub I. So we take I runs over, for example, the candidates for office. I won't be very technical here, though some of the ideas back of what I say are rather, but we need this notion of entropy. We'll see that there's quite a deep reason for using entropy as the measure of freedom. So understand that what I'm proposing is that the way to measure freedom, in the sense of the measure of uncertainty, is entropy. So we can talk about the entropy of an election or of a market. Let me give you some rather different. One of my non-favorite places for political freedom is Singapore. And as you can see, these are the elections for the parties 80, 81, 84, 88, 91, and you can see the entropy is very close to zero, which is a very clear reflection of the absence in these elections of any serious competition among, actually, the candidates in terms of the votes cast. This is in terms of the parties. Now, rather nicely, in terms of using such a measure of entropy, if we look at elections in Taiwan, they're improving a good deal more. Taiwan is on a program of progressive liberalization. And that's shown in this increase in the entropy of the elections from 83 to 92. So it isn't just American elections that the measure is designed for. Now, we can also consider how this notion works when we look at markets. And here is just one example. This is the market for manufacture in the United States based on the data for the 200 largest manufacturing companies from 47 to 1970. This is taken from the historical statistical abstracts of the United States. And we just look at these at the entropy, looking at the conditional distribution among the 200, and we can see that it's not very much changed. So that if we ask about the freedom of the market among the largest manufacturers, for example, it could be that we consider the largest 200, but in fact, of course, there is an oligopoly, the largest 5 dominate or begin to dominate. Well, looking at these data, we can see that the freedom doesn't change very much over this important post-war period from 47 to 1970. Now, I'm starting because I want to bring out certain points with these social measures. I'll come back to individual autonomy. But what I've said thus far about entropy, we can find actually in the economic literature. If you look in topics like industrial organization or research on markets, there will be a measure, one of the measures proposed will be entropy by looking at the markets just like I looked at that or the way we've looked at elections. But that's actually, in my view, not a very deep way to consider the freedom of social institutions such as markets or elections. There's a much more important way to look at it, which, as far as I can see, has been quite neglected in the economic literature as well as in the literature of political science, and not discussed also by philosophers previously. And that's what I call stochastic freedom. What is important in stochastic freedom is not simply to look at a given election or a market at a given time, but to consider the process over time. What kind of electoral process is at work in a country? Or on a given market, how does it operate over a period of time? Just even from one transition period, from one period to another. So we don't want, as I've considered thus far, simply to consider the cross sections, but we want to consider the entropy rate for stochastic processes. And now we'll come back and see that I want to reflect ideas that I start with here in these social institutions. We'll want to reflect back on individual behavior. But let's consider further this idea of rate, of entropy rate, in considering elections or markets. Now this is the only, essentially the only rather technical looking overhead I'll put up. This is just the entropy rate of where we have a process, like in elections, and then we take, the stationary consideration, the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over n, h of this sequence, will be the rate. But the rate's a rather natural concept of rate. Nancy. Yes, let me point up here. And now our Bernoulli process, and that's a notion we'll use because it's so simple and straightforward. Our Bernoulli process is when these random variables or individual cross sections are independent, probabilistically, and have the are identical in their probability parameters, their distribution. And so then, the limit, we just get n of h over of h of x1 over n, and that's just the process itself. And so in the case of Bernoulli processes, in that case only, we get exactly the same, the entropy rate is exactly the same as the cross-section. But that's a very special case. Because one of my ways of saying that libertarians are really not quantitatively serious, I'm a sort of natural libertarian, but a skeptical one, that libertarians are not quantitatively serious is that the natural radical libertarian position should be that all elections and markets should be Bernoulli. But imagine the chaos of that. They would have the maximum freedom. Intuitively easy to see that the Bernoulli processes have the maximum freedom. But what does that mean? On every occasion, what product you buy, what candidate you vote for, what party you are in, randomly changes independently from one occasion to another. So there's no tradition at all. It'd be a sort of nightmare for marketing forces or for campaign managers in any place in the world. So Bernoulli markets or Bernoulli elections are the extreme point. Very important concept, as we'll see as we go along. Now, why the process is important? Suppose we had three markup process for three states. These could be three parties or three sellers. And this is the probability along here. This is just the probability. If you bought from this zero producer, then you'd stay buying from him by probability 1 minus 2 epsilon. That's a transition probability. The same for buying from the second producer or the third one labeled 2. Now, the interesting thing about that is that independent of epsilon, the cross-sectional probability because of the symmetry is 1/3. And that's easy to see. But if everybody was fixed, and if you always voted for the zero party and always voted for the first party or the second party,
Then, in other words, the entropy rate approaches zero as epsilon goes to zero. So this is why the rate concept is very much more important than the cross-sectional concept. You can get from situations that are quite free intuitively exactly the same rate as you get from processes that don't seem free at all.
And it's why looking at the cross-sectional data is not nearly sufficient in terms of freedom. Now, notice something. I'm emphasizing very much in this analysis of freedom the concept of process. It is too easy in our philosophical and economic or political analysis of freedom to concentrate on individual events at a given time. But it's rather like Aristotle's analysis of eudaimonia or flourishing. What is important in order to flourish is what happens over a considerable period of time, or as he might say, a lifetime. Well, the same way here, freedom really is evident over some very considerable patch of time, not over simply one single cross-section event. And again, I think this has not been emphasized enough. Let me just give you a couple of examples. Here's a very nice piece of data on the transition data on choices of soft drinks. This was done with several hundred individuals choosing over several months these various soft drinks. Most of them, not all of them perhaps, I think are available in Britain as well as in the United States. Certainly Coke is. Coca-Cola, of course, dominates. So understand how this is read. This is, you chose Coke, the probability you would choose Coke the next time is 0.61, and so forth. Now, the overall entropy, in terms of rate, of this process is 1.84. And I'll show you some very similar data now in the automobile market. And one of my points here is, even though these markets are very different, we can compare their sense of freedom by looking just at their entropy rate. Here are data on a sample of over 7,000 purchases of automobiles. And the choices are broken into the category of Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, and a foreign car. This is in the American market. Even though the choices are smaller in number, the way the data have been categorized, the entropy is still, well, it's just accidental, it's 1.84, is about the same as for the soft drinks. And the reason is that no one of the four categories dominates the way the drinking of Coca-Cola dominates the soft drinks market. So the freedom of these two markets is rather comparable. And you see what I'm proposing, and I'll give some more reason for that, is that this single measure is a good way of judging the freedom of this particular market, or in another occasion, some particular sequence of elections. Let me give you one more example. As you might imagine, if you go into the consumer data, there's a great deal of analysis, because these matters are of considerable interest in marketing research. Who buys what? The same kind of transition data, whether you stayed or changed, in buying refrigerators, where these are people who did early replacements, that is, less than 9 years. And you can see GE, Sears, Whirlpool, and other, which is small. And again, the entropy in that market is roughly the same as the others,
about 1.78. So there's quite a bit of competitiveness or freedom in this market for refrigerators.
Now we come back to some theoretical ideas of why this measure of entropy, and this is really a fundamental point, why this measure of entropy is the right way to think about freedom. I've been giving you a lot of down-to-earth examples, and now I want to give you some of the theory that's back of the viewpoint that I'm proposing. And this material can be rather technical, and I've tried to simplify it to get the basic idea. In processes that we're measuring the freedom of, a market or election sequence, we require technically that the process be stationary, that is, it doesn't really change over time, and that's just for carrying through the ideas. That's an idealization that'll be only approximately satisfied in practice. But we say that two stationary stochastic processes are isomorphic. If we can map events of one onto events of the other, preserving probability. So we have these two, for example, an election and a market, are isomorphic in their uncertainty structure. They are different in many other respects. If we can map events from here to events over here, and also the other way, so that the probability of the event being mapped is the same here and the same here. All right? So that's the notion of isomorphism. And the meaning of this is that their structural, if we can do such a mapping, that their structural uncertainty is the same. So if two markets or elections have the same uncertainty structure, are isomorphic, then we want to say they exhibit the same freedom. Not that they're same in all respects, of course, just like we see markets that are rather different in number of products, etc. But they are the same in their uncertainty structure, and it's the uncertainty structure that I'm saying is essential for the characterization of freedom. And what I'm proposing is that this is what has not been given adequate thought in prior philosophical analyses of freedom. Now, there are some beautiful modern results that relate entropy exactly to this. And let me state in a very informal way some important results. The first theorem, and I've used the language I'm using here, Kolmogorov and Sinai didn't use this language, of course. If two Bernoulli or Markov markets are isomorphic, then their entropies are the same. So I notice that the isomorphism structure of these processes is a very complicated thing. And the entropy is a very simple thing, just a simple numerical measure. Now what is remarkable, that it wasn't clear even until about 56, 57, whether two Bernoulli processes, just flipping a coin half-half and a three-sided die, which you can build in a natural way out of a triangle, are isomorphic. That was settled. And then in 1970, a Stanford mathematician showed that if two Bernoulli markets, that is Bernoulli processes, have the same entropy, they are isomorphic. So now we have an if and only if. And this single number characterizes isomorphism of structure. And it's really one of the most remarkable results about uncertainty structure available in any analysis of uncertainty in the last half century. So simplifying, leaving out a couple of conditions, We can summarize then. Two Bernoulli or Markov markets are isomorphic if and only if they have the same entropy. There are a couple of technical things to add there that I won't bother with now. So we have two important ideas. One is isomorphism of uncertainty structure, and secondly, the remarkable fact that this isomorphism of uncertainty structure can be characterized for these processes just by the entropy rate of the process. And so we have, then, a remarkably simple measure of the freedom of a market, or the freedom of an election, where we're thinking now of the process over several periods. And the fact that we can get this kind of characterization is not something necessarily to be anticipated. Now, some of you will feel that this analysis I've given you is fairly far removed from much of the philosophical analysis of freedom. Well, there's one or two other issues that I want to cover that you may still feel are a little removed from the classical philosophical tradition, but I think are fundamental to the analysis of freedom. And I mentioned at the beginning diversity. And there are two puzzles, that can motivate the treatment of diversity. The first was formulated by Ken Benmore. Benmore in a conference in Cannes in 94, where I first talked about these ideas. He said, what about an election in which the two candidates seem essentially identical from a political viewpoint? So maybe, say, these two seemingly identical candidates each get 50% of the vote. Do we still want to claim that we have a free election? Well, that's a natural puzzle to consider. And I think, at least in first approximation, a rather simple analysis of that phenomena can be given. The idea is that for a given person or group, say an electorate, let there be just a certain number of properties, let's say M, or characteristics that are relevant for a candidate or product. A candidate in an election, or in a market. And when I say election or market here, I think also of the process. And to give a simple characterization, let these properties be just qualitative ones. So either the candidate or the product has or doesn't have the property in question. Then for M relevant properties, there are just 2 to the M type, possible types of candidates or products. And the answer that I then propose is obvious. We then compute the entropy, not for the individual candidates, but for the number of types and the vote that each type is getting. So, for example, if we have an election, and this is why many people individually say that there is no freedom in an election on occasion, is when the two candidates, from their standpoint, are too much alike in their political and economic views. If one judges the two candidates to be of just the same type, then no matter how the vote is distributed, the entropy in that election, according to this measurement of diversity as characterized by types, would be 0, and there would be no freedom. The second puzzle is this. given just the measurement of entropy as the measurement of freedom, why not consider the best election in the sense of freedom, the one where each voter votes for himself or herself? The result that obviously has the maximal cross-sectional entropy, and therefore freedom, for a given population of voters. And that's also a puzzle. When types are introduced, we can, of course, speak in terms of just the number of types, which for a large population would be considerably less. But it is worth noting that there is another and different theoretical solution to this second puzzle about why isn't the best election, for example, one in which each voter votes for himself or herself. Well, perhaps you can guess already the answer. Consider the process in which each voter always votes for himself or herself. Then the transition matrix has simply ones in the diagonal and zero elsewhere, and the entropy of that process of each voter voting for himself or herself is simply zero, and the process has no freedom according to the measure I propose whatsoever. Well, there's a second elaboration now of these ideas about type. Probably the first criticism to be made of this preliminary analysis of diversity, which is only meant to be preliminary here, the first criticism to be made is that different properties of candidates or products are of a different importance to voters or to buyers. So, for example, in the case of election, a candidate's views on the budget for the national parks is in general much less important than the properties of his views on foreign policy, and we want to attach greater weight to the latter. And it's easy to extend the analysis I've given to add weights to the types. And so we weight the types according to their importance for the individual or the group in order to give a weighted measure of freedom in terms of the relevance or the comparative relevance or importance of the properties of the individual candidates or products. Now there's a second analysis of diversity that is quite important in economic research on the behavior of consumers. And this concerns not the candidates or products, but the diversity of buyers and voters. Underlying the ergodic concepts, and what I've been talking about is using ergodic concepts to characterize freedom in terms of entropy, is the condition that in principle, the sample path of choices of each buyer or voter should replicate in time the features of the full process. This allows for no significant relevant differences between buyers or voters, and is consequently too restrictive. An approach to the study of consumer behavior that is widely used is divide consumers into classes forming submarkets. The most widely used division, you could probably guess, and to use the terminology used in that literature, is the division between loyalists and shoppers. And that also applies to voters. So loyalists would be people who always buy the same product brand or vote for the same party, regardless. And shoppers are those who look in detail at the character of the products and shop around, and also shop around in voting for candidates. And what is done then is to analyze individual submarkets, and one can analyze the freedom of individual submarkets according to such a division. I won't try to pursue that here, but it is a topic, of course, of great interest to individuals concerned with the behavior of consumers in markets or the behavior of voters in elections. Now, these practical considerations
applied to political and economic problems, are the taking off point, but by no means the end of the analysis I give of freedom. And I want to conclude with several general philosophical remarks and return again to the concept of individual autonomy. The latter part of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is devoted to four antinomies that pure reason can generate. All four of the antinomies are about problems that have a long history in philosophy. The first concerns whether the world is finite or infinite in space, and whether it has a beginning in time or the past is of infinite extent. I do believe that Stephen Hawking is not very much aware of this long tradition, which includes wonderfully sound views of St. Thomas Aquinas. The second antinomy concerns whether matter is continuous or discrete. The third, that is the third antinomy of Kant, concerns causality and is my focus here. Do all phenomena have determinate causes? Some that do not. Although Kant concludes by adopting the deterministic view, in his proof of the contrary, and that is in the analysis of the antinomy, he introduces just the right theoretical concept of freedom, namely, as a property of a cause that is itself absolutely spontaneous. And it's part of the genius of Kant that he puts his finger on exactly the concept that is needed to introduce freedom into the world of nature. To eradicate the bugaboo of universal determinism that has plagued the discussion of freedom since ancient times, we need to accept Kant's third antinomy as genuine by recognizing there is no scientific basis to support universal determinism. Additional modern support comes from results of the kind in ergodic theory that I've been talking about in characterizing the isomorphism of the structure of uncertainty of processes. Now, the isomorphism of the structure of uncertainty is not itself enough to make empirically indistinguishable determinate or deterministic and indeterministic processes. But if we add to this concept of isomorphism that I introduced earlier a concept of geometric congruence with a fixed finite accuracy of measurement, then for a variety of ergodic systems, such indistinguishability can be proved. Because billiards have served as a philosophical paradigm of a mechanical system, a vivid example of such indistinguishability is the motion of a single billiard ball on a table with a convex object shaped like this, say, in the middle of the table. A case of what is called Sinai billiards, after the Russian mathematician Yaji Sinai. Making the usual idealizations, such as that the ball is a point particle and that perfect elasticity and reflection hold, we can show ergodic behavior on the part of the ball, construct an ergodic measure for the deterministic Newtonian mechanical theory of the ball's motion, and prove isomorphism as defined earlier, but even more, prove congruence with finite accuracy with the following property. We have congruence of a stochastic Markov model of the motion of the billiard with the Newtonian deterministic model. No matter how many observations we make with finite accuracy, fixed finite accuracy, of the motion of the billiard ball, we cannot decide whether the billiard ball is executing according to the laws of a stochastic process or according to Newtonian mechanics. As I put it in another publication, arguments of this kind show that the concept of universal determinism is a transcendental notion. It is, in Kantian terms, a notion that transcends experience. Now, the important point in the present context is it is that kind of argument that makes a place for freedom. And as I like to put it, we put, to reverse Kant, we put determinism, universal determinism, among the transcendental notions and make freedom an empirical notion. The empirical character of markets, elections, and individual behavior is a matter for study, not for transcendental characterization. I mentioned at the beginning individual autonomy as a central aspect of freedom. I now want to argue for the close relation of such autonomy to the ergodic behavior of free markets and elections. The behavior of markets and elections is made up of the choices of many individuals. Moreover, it is a fundamental result of ergodic theory, already mentioned, that the individual sample paths of a stationary process reproduces the main features of the process, that is, ideally, the choices over some considerable time of a given individual. As the saying goes, for such processes, the time averages equal the ensemble averages. This means that typical individuals exhibit the same degree of unpredictability as the process as a whole. We scarcely expect markets or elections to be Bernoulli processes without any memory of the past, and the same is true of individuals. But we also do not expect the entropy to be zero, and this is also true of individuals. The surest sign of individual autonomy in economic and political choices is uncertainty, and thus unpredictability to some degree, and even when focused only on the individual decision maker. Perhaps even more important, this factor of unpredictability in autonomous individual choice is present for either deterministic or stochastic models of behavior. Put another way, as I've tried to argue, there are far-reaching theoretical reasons for holding that inherently unpredictable features of autonomous individual choice cannot be eliminated by any deterministic psychological model of choice, no matter how appealing its concepts may seem. If we cannot successfully predict the behavior of billiard balls, we are unlikely to do so for human behavior. Now, let me give a contrast to that. I think I have it here, and I'd like to. I'd better extol Kant, but I don't want to go overboard. Here's a famous quotation from the last of the, towards the end of the Critique of Pure Reason. All the acts of a man, so far as they are phenomena, are determined from his empirical character and from the other concomitant causes, according to the order of nature. And if we could investigate all the manifestations of his will to the very bottom, there would be not a single human action which we could not predict with certainty and
recognized from its preceding conditions as necessary. Now, I want to stress that here, I think, Kant has very much gone astray. It's exactly a central thesis of the argument here that it's essential to the concept of freedom that the behavior of the individual is unpredictable, no matter how much you may think you know about that individual. And I remind you that the finest and simplest example of this can always be found by thinking of the simple Sinai billiard on a billiard table. And if you can't predict the behavior of the billiard ball, how in God's name could you hope to predict the behavior of a complicated human being making choices? So let me conclude with the good life and a free society. What do we expect of the good life in a free society? The invisible hand of competition produces an unbounded richness of products. Freedom of choice leads to unpredictable behavior of individuals, anathema to totalitarian societies, unpredictable behavior of individuals. The same forces oppose excessive regulations and controls. And what characterizes properly a free society is the fourth and final thing I want to say, that individual autonomy of choice is present in every area of experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Suppes. Professor Suppes has kindly agreed to field some questions from the audience on the topic of his lecture, and I'd like to invite you to pose your questions. We have some mobile microphones, so if you would please raise your hand if you wish to ask a question. A microphone will appear, and then if you would speak into the microphone and preferably give your name first. David Miller.
Hello, this is David Miller. Can I just ask a... Is that working? Something very unpredictable about this.
Yes.
This microphone.
It's a free microphone.
When you gave your examples of calculating entropy values, you used as the idea of probability just seemed to be a frequency there. Could you say a little bit more about what, in the general case, what idea of probability you're using? Presumably frequency is only applies to these rather special cases that you dealt with. And I would have thought an idea such as the propensity idea, which you've written about as well in the way that Popper did too, would be more appropriate and is itself going to bring in an idea of unpredictability on its own. Am I right about that? Or are you going to stick to frequency or even some other idea of probability in these entropy calculations?
Did everybody hear the question? David Miller is asking, what is the notion of probability that I use?
Well, I'm very pluralistic about that, David. I mean, so that for many purposes of theoretical analysis, you would like something like a propensity notion. But of course, for empirical applications, in the case of physics, you often deal primarily with actual frequencies. And so that for a detailed analysis, one would take as an approximation, for instance, relative frequencies. And of course, as you know,
unless we think there is an enormous collusion between voters,
the very large samples we get in elections or in any kind of market gives us quite a robust notion of probability to use. So I'm not really unhappy with that, and I think that it's what we would expect to use as we do in other kinds of applications. So I'm saying for theoretical purposes, we might want to take a somewhat different view. For applications, not so. Now maybe...
Can I come back on that? I agree that for measurement, I agree that for measurement probabilities generally, that is just a problem about their measurement and the empirical work. I'd have thought otherwise it's always the theoretical approach they're concerned with. I mean, what is the conceptual structure of what's going on here? Why is entropy a good measure of freedom? It's presumably because we have some more abstract probabilistic idea being used there. And the force of my question, I mean, it's not meant to be a very punitive question, but the force of it was, isn't any propensity idea itself going to introduce just that sort of unpredictability that, I mean, I agree with you, is it freedom generally?
Well, what you said at the end, I certainly agree with that, that essentially any notion we use will introduce the uncertainty, any notion of probability. Instead, I could expand on that a bit further, because to some extent in philosophical discussions, what notion of probability we use can be quite important in various directions. Now, one of the things that is characteristic of the introduction, if we want to go back to where I brought these ideas from in ergodic theory, there really isn't any developed notion of probability beyond simply the formal characterization of it. And what we assume is that in any example, any applications, those formal properties will be approximately satisfied. And that's what's going on here. And a commitment to some particular interpretation is not really present in the basic development, for example, of ergodic theory. On the other hand, I think the way in which we naturally interpret it in applications is reasonably straightforward affair. I'm not sure that. But I think it is important what I said about, I've come to see this what I call what is fundamentally the basic pragmatic attitude of physicists and individuals working on physical systems. They are rather pragmatic about the notion of probability they actually use.
Gentleman over here.
What would you say is the driving force of freedom? I mean, where does it start? Does it start with uncertainty or diversity of choice or with autonomy? Which is sort of the main, the most important factor?
Well, it's a good question. The question is, where does freedom really start? With uncertainty, with diversity, or individual autonomy? And I would want to be careful in the answer to that. I think that in the empirical study of freedom, as whether we claim that in a given society markets are free, we assume, if we have some diversity of candidates, that really the central piece of evidence will be the uncertainty in the outcome, that is, the division of the vote. But if it were simply a put-up job, so to speak, where there was a pretense of having an equal division, but in fact... individuals knew who were very familiar with the situation that it was not what we thought it was, then of course we would not accept the phenomenology of uncertainty as being sufficient. So we would also require some analysis of evidence of individual autonomy. So I don't really want to put one ahead of the one of those properties ahead of the others. Even though in the in many cases of analysis, we will do the most work on the concept of uncertainty. And I think that the point that I wanted to push in this lecture, put forward, is that it is uncertainty that is most neglected in the classical philosophical tradition of the analysis of freedom.
Morris Melvin.
When you discuss diversity, for example, different candidates with different characteristics, are they really different for the question of freedom of choice? You said we could characterize it by taking those into account. But what if I have a situation, which is not uncommon, that for some of the electorate, certain characteristics are important and certain characteristics are not important. And so from the point of view of some electorate, there might be a lot of diversity among candidates, say, in an election. From the point of view of another subset of electorates, there might be zero diversity in terms of those characteristics that they consider important for the electorate. In this case, how do we classify the system? Because you were wanting to clarify, is this process free, or more free, or less free? Wouldn't, in that case, we have, well, if you look at it from the point of view of this group, it's free. If you look at it from the point of view of this group, it isn't free. What do we do then?
I think that I agree with the kind of example you give. And I think that if we do as I think it is natural in analysis of, for example, elections, think of the weighting of attributes according to their importance, if we give that a subjective character, then we will get, and I think properly should, exactly the kind of results you describe. That is, the notion of freedom, and certainly in ordinary political talk, there is much to support that. The notion of freedom then becomes relative to the group you are considering. So that for individuals, so-called, well, a classical example, voters who are one-issue voters, if both candidates have the same position, and in particular the wrong position, then for those individuals there is really no substantive choice in the election. And I think it's probably, we may want to do something further in aggregation, but I think a very good place to begin is with the acceptance of that fact and the recognition. Now, I think there is something more to be said about it. When I talked about the good life and the free society at the end, one of the things we expect in a free society is to cater. There is some effort to cater to individuals that are quite diverse in their tastes, temperaments, and beliefs. So, for example, in the case of products, it's a well-known fact that people can do very well with niche products that cater exactly to people who have tastes that are different from the dominant ones. And that same phenomena, to some extent, is true in the case of political candidates. It's harder there in many ways, but we see cases of the same thing. So what we expect is that unless your individual views are so idiosyncratic that there is no real group around you holding somewhat similar views, we would expect markets and elections to cater to these subpopulations, and that's the way I think it should be in a free society. I don't know whether you're happy with
it.
Yeah.
I think it's harder in political groups because it's a package good.
Yeah.
You're buying a bundle. So you're buying a candidate. And if the majority votes for a candidate, you're offered a package of issues. And it's difficult to split them. Well, in a market, but that's standard stuff in the differentiation between market and
Though there are certainly
political systems.
On the other hand, that's certainly true of markets. I mean, if you want highly idiosyncratic features in your automobile, you can get it, but only at an enormous cost. So if you're willing to pay $2 million to have a really unusual automobile, beautifully made, you can get it. But in the ordinary, roughly market prices, you can't get much diversity on many features because it's too expensive in relation to the market to provide that diversity. So in a way, you have packaging in the same way, I agree, that you have in the case of political candidates for expensive products.
There are four people who wish to ask question five, and not that very much time. So could I ask you to be brief? I've got one question here, there, and then there. Nancy, Cartwright.
Pat, as I understand the structure of your argument, from freedom to entropy as a measure of freedom, it goes in the steps like this. You go from freedom to autonomy, from autonomy to unpredictability, and from unpredictability to entropy. So what I wanted to ask is what you would say to what I take to be the sort of standard line to stop that motion. And I take it the standard line is something like this, entropy has to do with lack of predictability from observation of past behavior. That's what entropy has to do with. But this kind of unpredictability is no violation of autonomy. That I think the line would be that you're punning on the concept of unpredictability here, that autonomy has to do with unpredictability from possible antecedent causes, but not unpredictability from past behavior. Now, to think that the two are the same or the two get conflated, we must make the assumption that the constancy of behavior that we're seeing is a result of some kind of abiding character, and then the abiding character gets to be the antecedent cause. So we make the conflation of the two by assuming that it's due to an antecedent, an abiding character, and I see that you quite logically then criticized Kant for assuming that there was such an abiding character that was going to produce the results in this case. But we don't need to think. I mean, I think this is the standard line. We don't need to think that the regularity in decisions occurs because of some kind of constancy of character, but rather it has a different source. It comes from the repeated exercise of free will in a similar way. So the claim is that you're getting entropy as a measure of freedom by going through two different, by, you know, entropy, unpredictability, but it's this kind of unpredictability that gives you, I'm sorry, freedom, unpredictability, but it's this kind of unpredictability that gets you entropy, so that you're just punning in the middle.
I don't agree with that.
Well, the question is, what did you... Where are you going to stop the standard response there?
Oh, no, I will say. See, I think that the central thing is the phenomenology of unpredictability, and that actually what is the empirical feature of human choice in a free society is, in fact, the unpredictability. So where you and I would perhaps disagree are on the empirical facts. My claim would be that this discussion about, you know, the constancy of decision-making is, in fact, a myth, that whenever you study human behavior in detail, it's an enormously unpredictable and not at all constant. So it's part of my thesis, which I'm... We don't have time to settle all the issues here about that. But I think that that's a... what is driving my intuitions is that at the level of the individual, it is exactly the unpredictable character of all the kinds of choices that individuals make that starts the show for me in thinking about it intuitively. Yeah, well, and that's exactly the connection. But I'm using that as the connection. I'm making that the actual uncertainty the primary evidence
of freedom. Now, there's where we may disagree. You may think there are some other characteristic, and that's what I would say, where we disagree about what that other characteristic is.
Well, I was only starting with the Kantian argument
today.
Yeah, yeah. There's another question at the back.
Well, but my claim is, Nancy, that Kant's argument, you see, doesn't really do enough. I mean, and just as the quotation gives, he took off in the wrong direction, as he did in his handling of the third antinomy.
May I repeat my request that the question be kept brief?
I had a question about the utility of these Ornstein-Kolmogorov theorems, which I understand gives you a one-to-one mapping from an entropy value to a market structure with isomorphism. Now, in practice, including in your examples, when you're taking different cases, you don't get the same entropy number. You may get numbers that are fairly close together. Are there theorems which will say something like, if two entropy numbers are close together but not equal, then the structures are in some way isomorphically similar as well? Presumably that, in fact, is false. I mean, you had a case where you had a market dominating in one case and not in another, but the entropy numbers were different.
Yes, I mean, that's a good question, and with the strong assumptions of stationarity you have, that you would get continuity considerations in terms of the numbers and the structure, so that the structures would be very close in their isomorphism when the entropy result is very close. Well, what we have we would expect, there are conditions you can, but what you would expect is that the probability of an event here minus the probability of the event mapped over here would be less than epsilon for some small epsilon. And that would be true for all events except for those of a set of measure less than epsilon. It would be a typical sort of condition.
One last question at the back.
Right. When Malcolm Muggeridge went off to Soviet Russia to be the foreign correspondent for the Manchester Guardian, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who had something to do with the setting up of the LSE, I believe, gave him a fountain pen. And they told him when they gave him this fountain pen, they'd have to hurry around looking for the right kind of fountain pen to give him. When he got to Soviet Russia, there would be none of that nonsense, because there'd only be one Soviet fountain pen, the state pen, and this would be a great advantage compared to the horror of capitalism and choice. Now, obviously, we can laugh at how quaint that sounds now, perhaps for most of us anyway, but there did seem to me to be a slight paradox in your use of the entropy measure for characterizing freedom in markets and in elections. It seems that the entropy measure increases when there's disagreement among individuals about what it is that they want. Now, I'm not clear how that impacts on markets, but on electorates it seems that entropy increases the more people are disappointed in getting the outcome of the election to be something that they didn't want. So where everybody votes for the same candidate, and presumably everyone is thereby happy, but by your measure, that's not so good, that's not so free.
In my characterization of the good life in a free society, I didn't say enough about the processes in that I expect in a free society. The way in which entropy keeps being produced, so to speak, is by the competitiveness, and let's say in the case of markets, and the same applies to elections, by the competitiveness of the producers of products or candidates in an election. They make an effort to cater to the desires of the buyers or voters, and they competitively do that catering. And as they do that competitive catering to the desires of the buyers or voters, so they're continually trying to take advantage. One has a piece of the market, another tries to get it. Of course, the individual producers or individual candidates would, of course, like to have zero entropy and have it all themselves. But it's exactly the competitive forces that produce the entropy, and each trying to do something that is more satisfactory from the standpoint of the buyer or voter. And that's why, in a free society, we would expect entropy to continue to be present and not disappear from elections or markets. It's that competitive improvement. Now, maybe we sometimes think products don't improve, and certainly not candidates. But there is a strong push to keep moving in ways that engage, and certainly that's the in democratic societies is the general thrust of candidates, is to engage a large number of the electorate. Whereas with the single fountain pen or the single candidate, the entropy is zero, and so is the freedom.
Okay. I know that there are quite a number of people who still wish to ask questions. You will have an opportunity to grill Professor Suppes, if you can get close to him. After this lecture, there's a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor of this building, to which you're invited. I was wondering, listening to the lecture, what Sir Karl Popper, had he been here, would have thought. And I'm sure that had he been here and had you managed to get to the end of your lecture, he would have admired it enormously for the elegance of the presentation and the precision of the thesis and the challenging nature of the thesis. He liked precise, contentful theses, which you presented us with. He liked it because they did have content, and also he used to say that they were criticizable. He probably would have criticized it, but he would have admired it enormously too. I don't know whether you know, but today is St. Clement's Day. You ought to know, since we're in the parish of St. Clement, and we have a St. Clement's building, and poor St. Clement lost his freedom by being thrown into the sea with an anchor weighing him down. It's also Thanksgiving Day, I believe, and these two facts, together with your very beautiful talk, prompt me to say thank you very much for this very nice lecture on freedom.